This podcast is supported by Amazon Music's new podcast, Country Heat Weekly. Hosts Kelly Sutton and Amber Anderson bring the beloved playlist to life. Every Thursday, Kelly and Amber deliver the vibrant world of country music right from Music Row in the heart of Nashville. The show reflects the energy, stylistic range, and diversity of today's country. And they'll be spilling that sweet tea about what's happening on the Nashville scene. Find and follow Country Heat Weekly on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your lightly awkward dress rehearsal of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. That was Company, the opening song from Stephen Sondheim's Company. That's from the original Broadway cast recording from 1970. As you may know, and if you're on the Facebook group, as you may have tapped in with me and requested, and so you definitely know, Stephen Sondheim passed away. He was 91. Sondheim fundamentally remade musical theater. At least that is what I believe. Longtime listeners of podcasts will know perfectly well that this is not my comfort zone. However, I am blessed to work at the New York Times alongside some of the most dedicated, forceful, and thoughtful thinkers on musical theater on the planet. So today we're going to get into Sondheim's career. We're going to talk about some of the essential works. We're going to talk about the ways in which he laid the template for modern musical theater. With us, Jesse Green is here. Jesse is the chief theater critic of the New York Times. Jesse, what's up? Coming from an undisclosed location in the woods.
Yes, I think I resent being called one of the uber nerds of the world, but okay.
I that's a compliment.
Oh,
in
sorry.
On this podcast, that's a compliment, just FYI.
I missed your tone. Got it now.
Okay, well, I guess my character's not being written very deftly today, so we'll work on it. We'll work on it. Also here, Elizabeth Vincentelli, no stranger to podcast. Elizabeth writes about music and theater for The Times and others. Elizabeth, hello.
Hello. I'm very happy that the last time I was on the podcast was to talk about Riot Girl. So I feel that I am covering a wide range.
I think for guests who have been on the podcast exactly twice, you have the widest spread between topics. You know, we get a lot of people who come back to just talk about something slightly to the left of what they talked about the first time. But you, no. You've got range. And I'm just imagining the curtain opening and it's you just having range, half Riot Girl, half musical theater. Okay, Jesse, let me start with you. I said to you before we started recording, don't infantilize me. Don't talk to me like a child. Don't explain things to me like a simpleton. That's actually not true. Talk to me a little bit like a child. Like any sentient consumer of culture, I am aware of the power of Sondheim's work. I've certainly engaged with some of it. But if you could explain, for my benefit, at least right now, a little bit of an entry-level breakdown of what Sondheim achieved and how his work was different from what came before it and how it shaped what came after it. All in 30 seconds. No, I'm just kidding. But no, just if you could talk us through the big picture, that'd be great.
Okay, little one.
Thank you. Thanks, Pop.
Well, yeah, it is the podcast. Sondheim, you know, grew up and was very early on through personal connections, a part of the tail end of the Golden Age, what we call the Golden Age of musical theater, the Rodgers and Hammerstein era. He was mentored by Oscar Hammerstein himself, who basically rescued him from a terrible family and a nutty mother and kind of adopted him and taught him a lot about how a Rodgers and Hammerstein combination might make musicals. So he was thoroughly steeped in that and practiced it in the first decade of his career. And then starting in 1970, really with Company, which we've just heard a little bit of, he proceeded to undo everything we knew about musical theater, both musically and lyrically. And of course, he was one of the great theater people who could do both at the greatest top levels, but also in terms of incorporating what was happening in American drama, bringing psychology to musical theater in a way that it had never experienced before, and later in his career changing it again, bringing a shift into more conceptual and abstract ideas into the musical stage. So there's your quick breakdown. He was the end of the Golden Age, and then he destroyed it.
And when, okay, but when you say he brought in sort of psychology and things of that nature, what was before, what was going on in the 60s and previously that he ended up breaking? What was the context that he ended up pushing against?
Well, you had plots and you had characters. The characters were thin. The plots were what the characters got up to and came out of. They tended, particularly in their music, not to be extremely deep. They didn't have a lot of contradictions, and there weren't a lot of ways for a lyricist in particular to describe the contradictions of a character or mixed feelings. And mixed feelings were not really a big part of the picture. So one thing is what he wanted to write about with his collaborators, with a lot more ambivalence and anxiety in the mix, but also just the tools he had in order to portray much more complicated people, even within the sounds that they were making as they sang.
Elizabeth Company, which we were listening to a little bit of before, that's about to have a revival. Where does Company fall in Sondheim canon? What pivot does it represent?
So it comes out in 1970, and it's the start of like an amazing run in the 1970s. Like the 70s, I think people agree that the 70s is like, obviously he's done great work before and after, but the 70s is his golden decade. And it's like he creates like one great show after another. It's Company, it's Follies right after, Little Night Music, Pacific Overtures, Sweeney Todd, they're all in the 70s, which is like a crazy run by any. It's like the Beatles between 64 and 69. Like it's the same thing. And Company is one of my favorite because it's probably the most pop, and I am a pop person at heart. Probably, I would say, more than a musical theater person. And the arrangements are very, very like Burt Bacharach. It's a very, very pop record. And that's why the songs are done all the time. And the show also has been like, I think the current revival is the third one. It's been revived. Someone was joking to me recently that it's been revived more than Annie. Mm. It's like, it's a wildly popular show. I wanted to go back to something that Jesse was just saying. Also, like Sondheim is often credited as really pushing the integration of the songs within the narrative, where the songs really push the narrative and the psychology of the characters. But what's interesting to me, and that's like one of the ambiguities, is that so they're really part and parcel of, they're so integrated into the show. And at the same time, like, I can't think of any other composer in musical theater that has had more reviews of his work where the songs are pulled out of context all the time than him.
Isn't that a lot because singers just love them and want to sing them? The other side of what you said, Elizabeth, is that for all of those reviews and cabaret concerts and all that, he had exactly one hit, Send in the Clowns, because they aren't extractable for the most part. They're way too specific, which actors love.
Okay, another baby question. What is Company about?
Company is very simple. It's a series of vignettes about a bachelor named Bobby, and all his friends are married and he's not. And he's having a kind of like life crisis of, why am I alone? And I mean, that's basically it. There's like not a real plot. And what's interesting with the current revival is that Bobby is played by a woman. So it's actually a pretty flexible show. It's very malleable. And it's also often interpreted as coded about sometimes being gay and lonely and looking for a suitable companion. I guess you could put it that way. So there's like multiple levels of reading. But for me, it really boils down is like the songs are crazy catchy. And in fact, it's very significant to me that it's the one show that the spoof series Documentary Now chose to parody it and called it co-op. The pastiche of the Sondheim style is spot on. And that's the thing. When you have someone as famous as Sondheim, it becomes an obvious target to spoof. And co-op is totally brilliant. It's really funny. The other thing that makes Company both popular and cult is that D.A. Pennebaker, who made a lot of rock documentaries, made a classic doc about the recording of the cast album, which is about an hour long. I've watched it like 10 times. It's like one of the craziest like music docs you could dream of. And so the documentary now spoofed pastiche both the musical and the documentary in half the time. It's like 25 minutes long. But it's great, yeah.
Let's check out a little bit of the documentary now, Sondheim spoof called Co-op.
I gotta go. Take 20.
I've gotta go. I gotta hail a pumpkin coach. Sink.
Take 22.
I wanna go. I wanna go to the eye doctor now, as previously stated, you pompous beta males.
I wanted to pick up on the idea of Sondheim kind of deepening what was happening psychologically in musical theater. Did a certain kind of actor or performer gravitate to Sondheim work? Were there people who really started to shine on Broadway because they were able to achieve things through Sondheim's work that maybe other musicals did not allow them to? Was there a generation of Sondheim specialists?
Well, there was definitely, it was generational, that you were now talking about a lot of trained actors. In the Golden Age, you had trained singers. Sondheim wanted actors who could sing, but he wanted both. But if he had to have one or the other, he said he wanted actors who could sing and who could understand what he was layering into his songs. Company's also notable because of the incredible story of ambivalence in it. You know, as Elizabeth was saying, this character Bobby doesn't know whether he wants to be alone or not, but it's more that he desperately doesn't want to be, and he is desperately appalled by the thought of being stuck. So both ends of that spectrum are pushed as far as they can. And Sondheim just, you know, in the lyrics, but also musically, layers all that in. And there's a lot more for an actor to do, which is not to say that the singing is very easy. It's not.
After Company comes Follies. What's going on with Follies? What's that about?
Follies is the story of a reunion on the stage of a former Ziegfeld-like theater as it's about to be torn down to be made into a parking lot. And two couples who were friends back in the day when the women in those couples each performed in the Follies and who each married the wrong person and who basically have a giant nervous breakdown on stage and go home ruined. That seem fair, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I would say this one is like, as a lot of songs also that became, I'm not sure about hits, but have been widely covered. One of my favorite, by the way, is the version of Losing My Mind that Liza Minnelli did with Pet Shop Boys from like 89.
Even I know that one.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind.
This is a show where he is deliberately stringing out for your pleasure and horror pastiches or, you know, satires almost of every great song form of the Golden Age and all of the great composers of the Golden Age. So here comes the Gershwin number. That's Losing My Mind. Here comes the Rodgers number and here comes the Kern number. But the thing is that he uses these not only to be lovely examples of their form, but to kind of deconstruct the understandings that were part of the psychology of those songs in the first place and use them to tell the story of the characters who, you know, sing them not randomly as they might in some 30s show, but as an expression of the dramatic situation they're in.
So he's doing two things simultaneously. He's doing kind of like a meta historical lesson on what had come before him, and then he's using them, those touch points, to serve his own dramatic purpose, correct?
That's very well said for a newcomer.
That is exactly it.
Phenomenal. Great. the new Kochi theater critic of the New York Times.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, John. But.
let me ask this, though, because I'm wondering, in this moment, in 1970, 71, obviously Sondheim has been putting on shows for many years prior to that. How is his reception, whether it's critical reception, fan reception, professional sphere reception, is there any pushback to the innovations that he's introducing? Is he widely hailed? What's the energy around him from the end of the 60s coming into the 70s?
He is not widely hailed. He's considered a minor melodist. Unhummable was what was constantly being thrown at him, and an overly clever and cold lyricist, and basically a young pest, I would say. I mean, it's better than when he wrote the lyrics for West Side Story. He was not mentioned at all in any reviews. So I guess it's an improvement. But there was a long time before people, I would say before he taught people how to hear him.
I think also what's important is the general context also, not just of musical theater at the time, but like the pop landscape at the time. Because, you know, I mean, there's been obviously a gazillion articles about him recently. And there was one on a reputable website. not ours.
are there other reputable websites besides ours?
I know. Well, fairly reputable. But it was titled How the Iconic Composer Helped Bring Musical Theater to the Mainstream. And I was like, wow, could you get this any more wrong? When he was growing up, the musical theater was the mainstream. When he was really at the peak of his power, the musical theater was leaving the mainstream. I mean, the last cast album to be number one on the Billboard chart was like Hair in 1968, 1969. And none has done that since, not even Hamilton. So his rise coincides with the decline of the influence of musical theater on the mainstream, where it becomes its own thing. And that to me is like it's a very interesting thing. It's a chicken and egg. Like, is he contributing with this kind of quote unquote unhummable lyrics to this kind of ghettoization of musical theater, or is it kind of like caught in something that's happening anyway?
Right. So basically, is he the one who's kind of deflating the balloon, or is he in a sense benefiting from the fact that the balloon is already deflating because it frees him up to do it his own way?
Yeah. I mean, there's like a lot of questions happening because it's all happening, I would say, in the early 70s. I'm really not sure. I mean, it's something that it's unclear to me, but it's really interesting to think about. Like, is he helping precipitate that deflating of the balloon? Is he being freed by it? Would the balloon deflate with or without him? And the fact that his string of great shows coincide exactly with that moment. And then what's weird, well, not weird, but kind of exciting to me to think about, like in a more like general picture, is that in the past like 15, 20 years, so musical theater comes back into some kind of fashion, sort of. And I really think Glee was huge for that. Actually, the TV show Glee, his show Into the Woods is produced all the time in high school and colleges in a kind of truncated version. But regardless, that means that you have a lot of teenagers who adore him. And and if you go to like the Broadway Con or theater, you see like a lot of young kids who are really into Sondheim. And that kind of boggles the mind a little bit, but it's great. Like Sondheim and Newsies, who knew?
The question that came to mind, Elizabeth, when we're sort of thinking through what was happening in those years, look, if Sondheim was being dismissed as unhummable, or he was not making these kind of like big shows that were happening in the 60s that had mainstream appeal, was nobody else also making shows like that in the early 70s? Like, was Sondheim like the indie guy up against like kind of like big Broadway, or was the balloon deflating all across the Great White Way?
I think he's kind of the indie guy against the major label dinosaurs. You know, I don't know if that's hindsight, but I think that feels kind of like an accurate perception, because I mean, he has some hits, but a lot of them tank too. And he's really perceived as Jesse was saying earlier, he's perceived as a bit of a like a brainiac who's a little full of himself, you know, and very pleased with his own smarts.
My kind of guy. Sounds great. Like,
and also as a New Yorker, I think it's important to say he was sort of the inside thing, like in that era, going to Elaine's or something like that. Or dare we mention Woody Allen? I mean, he had that kind of cachet, although he was on Broadway 5 times in 10 years, even if only one of those shows ever returned a profit. Maybe 2 of them did. But there wasn't a lot going on Broadway by then except him, because the whole thing had fallen apart.
Okay, so then, again, a basic question. So we're talking about these golden era Sondheim, like what we think of now as golden era. But you're telling me in their day, they're kind of like a little like, they're received a little coldly, a little icily.
Well, until he broke them down, yeah.
Okay, so when did that happen? When did popular opinion, etc., did everybody decide, okay, Sondheim's actually a genius? Did that happen in the 70s, or did that not happen until historians and critics really got to build up some evidence over years and years and years?
Well, I think it happened in the 70s. I think A Little Night Music was something that a lot of people could enjoy without feeling like they needed special knowledge. It was delicious music that didn't take special expertise to understand at the time. And I think that was a big change. And then by the time you get to Sweeney Todd, he had just basically battered everyone down to the point you just couldn't ignore how brilliant it was.
What is a hit in the context of musical theater? Do you mean a hit in the sense that it got played on the radio, it was on the Billboard charts? What constitutes a musical theater song being a hit in the early 1970s?
It's a hit when Barbara Streisand and Chrissy Duclan cover you. That's when it's a hit.
Sinatra and Judy Collins.
Yeah, it was covered a lot.
This was how it all used to work. I mean, before this balloon popped, most of the crooners and singers of the earlier era got their material. I mean, I'm not talking about the singer-songwriter generation, but the Sinatras and the Judy Garlands and people like that, they got their material from Broadway. And the publishers, the music publishers, would get it to them before the show was even out. And they would make a hit out of the song Cabaret before it ever opened.
This is what I was talking about earlier when I was talking about that, the headline, and how dumb it was. Because he did not bring the musical theater to the mainstream, because the musical theater was the mainstream. As Jesse just said, Sinatra and all those guys, Judy Garland, who were, the stars of their time, were getting their material from musical theaters. So that was the mainstream. And the back and forth between the two was constant. And that ceased, I would say, in the late 60s, very early 70s. That's it.
I can time it. It was 69.
69.
Well, according to John Kander of Kander and Ebb, who has a good reason to know, it happened between 68 and 69.
That's the peak of that is the Hair cast album. That's 68. And the number one hit songs from that were done by the Fifth Dimension. You know, so that's where the songs are coming from. And then after that, it kind of stops.
Oh, never again. That was it. That was the end of it. I think there's been two or three songs from Broadway that have charted since then.
This is really making me think some Broadway producer needs to feed a song to Billie Eilish. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, they try. Believe me, they try. But it's just the worlds are so divergent now that there's no bridge. There's nothing to cross. You can't get over.
Should we listen to the Sinatra version of Send in the Clowns, since it's sort of the canonical one, kind of?
Scooby-Doo, do it. You know, he with his breezy new lyrics, it's great.
All right, here's old Blue Eyes, Send in the Clowns.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns.
I'm Elise Hugh.
And I'm Josh Klein.
We're the hosts of Built for Change, a new podcast from Accenture.
The pandemic has radically transformed the way we do business.
And now is the time to forge a new path ahead. So what do the world's most innovative leaders think about navigating change? What strategies are working for them?
On Built for Change, we'll learn what Accenture has discovered about how businesses can rise to these challenges and find success.
Subscribe to Built for Change now so you don't miss an episode.
My name is Apoorva Mandaveli. I am a science and global health reporter at the New York Times. My job is to talk to scientists, to speak their language, to go deep with them, and then figure out how it is relevant to the everyday reader. I've reported on scientific concepts for about 20 years. Everything I have learned up to this point has helped me deliver the stories about COVID. I feel just an enormous responsibility to try to make sense of what we're learning about the virus, how to protect ourselves, I feel like I have been training for this job my entire life. Everybody at the New York Times is constantly thinking about asking the tough questions and making sure that our readers have all the information they need. But this all relies on you, our subscribers. We need you on board to keep the Times as a resource for everyone. If you're not a subscriber yet, you can become one by going to nytimes.com/subscribe.
The songwriters behind that kind of song were never very famous in the first place, and it didn't do anything for his fame, but it did earn him a lot of money, and I think maybe bought him his house in Connecticut. And perhaps that's not the kind of thing you're thinking of.
Well, frankly, if that created the conditions for him to create good art moving forward, then we have to talk about the financial contingencies of creating art.
Well, the house
art
in Turtle Bay was the West Side Story house, so... You know, the thing about Sending the Clowns is that he, of course, didn't write it to be a pop hit. He wrote it because there was a hole in a scene in Boston, and Hal Prince wanted a number for the leading lady. And Sondheim said, no, this scene is about the leading man. And they argued about it. And he sat down and he wrote it one night for a very specific moment and a very specific character who has a lot of subtextual things going on. It's not just, oh, you know, I had a love. It's a really complicated and very angry song in short breaths of phrases, both because the originator of the song, Glynis Johns, just couldn't sustain tones very long, but also because the character is so angry that she can only get out short phrases. And this is a subtlety that's just delicious for actors, but almost seems as if it would work against anyone else caring about it or doing anything with it. It's so specific in its imagery. The character is an actress, and all of the imagery is based on the theater. It's about clowns and losing your timing and other things related to the theater.
I've got to say, I could never figure out why of all that particular one became so big. I mean, I just, it's an enduring mystery to me. I just don't get it. That's just me.
So if I were to, as someone coming to it cold, if I were to listen to Sending the Clowns alongside three other songs from this musical or three other songs from the period from Sondheim, it may not be evident structurally.
I think it's pretty evident. I understand what Elizabeth is saying, but if you tried to make a hit out of the 9-minute act one finale that's a series of operetta takes, I don't think that was going to be a hit. This is a standalone ballad in short phrases that are quite easily singable. So there's a lot going for it that way.
What's interesting is that he actually wrote singles for movies. Like he wrote like songs for the movie Dick Tracy. He wrote like Sooner or Later, and like he wrote like three or four for Dick Tracy. And I think he even got an Oscar for that. So he could perfectly do that single. And in fact, I'm always surprised that he was not called upon more for that.
You know, I would dispute that he could do it perfectly.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
You know, I love the idea. But the thing is, when I listen to those songs that he wrote deliberately as pop songs, they often sound to me like he's either holding his nose or that he can't stop himself from being too clever for them. There's too many rhymes or, you know, there's just too much going on and they don't always sit very well. But when he wrote in a show, a song that is meant in the world of the show to be a popular song, like in Merrily We Roll Along, which is 1981. He has a song that's written by the singer-songwriter pair in the show that's supposed to become their hit. And that song is called Good Thing Going, and it's fabulous. It should, in an earlier era, would have been a hit. Sinatra did record it, and it was at least successful to that extent, but it didn't go anywhere on the charts or anything like that. In the context of a show, he could write a perfect pop song.
I still think that Sooner or Later is really good.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not good, but it doesn't feel like a real pop song to me. It feels like a theater person's idea of a pop song.
Let's listen to Good Thing Going. Y'all can be the judge if Sondheim was in his pop bag or not, circa 1981.
It started out like a song. Started quiet and slow with no surprise. And then one morning I woke to realize we had a good thing going.
Okay, we jumped over Sweeney Todd. We leapt over it.
In fear.
Okay. Sweeney Todd is, to my understanding, a crucial Sondheim production. What's the vibe? What's going on there?
Well, when I said in fear, I meant just because the plot. I mean, it's a plot about cannibalism and revenge, you know, in which Sweeney Todd murders his clients in his barbershop and his accomplice, Mrs. Lovett, bakes them into meat pies and sells them to the neighborhood. So I don't know how you felt about it, Elizabeth, but it to me is a great musical, but also a kind of terrifying one.
I would agree. Yes. There's often the question about it of whether is it a musical or is it an opera? That's the one where that question comes up a lot. I don't really have any position on that. It is what it is. She said brilliantly. And it's another one that's crazily works in so many different configurations. You can do it really big and really nuts, and you can do it really small with like a very small cast. And I've seen both, and they both work.
Okay, a plot that kind of over the top, how unusual was that on Broadway at the time?
There's never been a strong vein of thriller musicals. So that's just not a combo you tended to get. And Sondheim has a particular love for thrillers, and this is a sort of century-old British story that he happened upon in a play form in London. And this is one of the few of his musicals that came from his instigation. So that may tell you something. But, you know, he was at the peak of his power, so he found ways to musicalize it. I don't think it's an opera, but it is very heavily musicalized. It brings together so many of the themes and things he was working out in all of the previous shows, the psychology, the layering of intention underneath the apparent one, the use of subtext, and just quite beautiful music. So the most beautiful love song, one of the most beautiful love songs he ever wrote. Well, there's two in this show. One is called My Friends, which the Sweeney character sings to his razor, his razors, which had been lost to him for many years. And they return to him, and he sings lovingly to them. And the other one is called Pretty Women, which is a beautiful, sinuous melody that he sings while shaving and preparing to slice the throat of one of the people who'd done him wrong.
But is this him cashing in all the chits that he's earned in the prior 7 or 8 years and said, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a serial killer musical and y'all are going to watch it and like it and enjoy it. Like, is that what this is? Is this a flex, basically?
Well, maybe, but it's also that he was really fascinated by, as Jesse mentioned, he was really into this kind of story. And he actually wrote with Anthony Perkins a wacky and really wonderful movie called The Last of Sheila.
Oh, my God, Elizabeth, you know.
In the early 70s, which I quite like. Actually, it's been a knowledge. It's kind of like a cult thing, but it's been a knowledge as an influence on like Knives Out and stuff like that. And it's really perverse. And I think I love that side of him, actually. He was also really, really into puzzles. He wrote the cryptic puzzles for New York Magazine for a couple of years. And I think all this stuff, this interest in wordplay and The Last of Sheila is a very kind of darkly funny. This dark sense of humor is there all along. And I think that actually was misunderstood and for quite a while.
Let me just say about The Last of Sheila, I also wrote cryptic puzzles for a living for a little while in my youth. And this movie turns on an acronym and an anagram. And I couldn't follow it for the life of me.
Okay.
I still don't understand what's going on. Apparently it was cut to shreds and they removed the clues. But whatever, it's kind of a mess, but it is a lot of campy fun.
There is one Sondheim musical that I did see in the theaters. That's Into the Woods. There was also Sunday in the Park with George. Also, just for the uninformed, I know that not every musical that gets written and workshopped and done in a regional theater ends up on Broadway. Is Sondheim's batting average in the 70s 1,000? Is everything that he did end up on Broadway, or are there things that didn't make it?
Well, everything that was intended for Broadway made it. I mean, he did a couple of things deliberately not for Broadway, and those did not until much later. But, you know, now basically any toenail clipping that, you know, ever came off his body is being put on Broadway. So a lot of those shows were not hits, didn't make money. So it was almost a recognition of his brilliance that even if they weren't going to make money, they were going to do them. Or at least Hal Prince, who was his collaborator and director in those years, was going to do them.
As we're kind of getting near the end of the show, obviously we have to talk about the arc of Sondheim's influence. You have to talk about Lin-Manuel. I wonder if there is this kind of tastemaker critical interest in the 70s, but not mainstream success. At what point does the next generation, or not the next, does a subsequent generation say, you know what version of musical theater I'm interested in? I'm interested in the Sondheim version. And that's what I'm going to build upon. When does that start happening?
Well, I guess around the time of Rent and Tick, Tick, Boom and Superbia and the Jonathan Larson stuff that we see in the movie of Tick, Tick, Boom, in which Bradley Whitford plays Sondheim quite well, I want to say.
And what is Tick, Tick, Boom, just for those who don't know?
It was a musical that was being written by Jonathan Larson before Rent, and it has subsequently been turned into a kind of mashup of what it was and several other things he was writing. It's kind of a palimpsest of many things. In the movie,
first use of palimpsest on podcast. Congratulations. First use.
For Netflix. I think it's on Netflix, right?
Yeah. So in the movie version of it, at a particularly low point in the main character's life as a musical theater composer, lyricist, wannabe, he gets incredible support from Sondheim that just, you know, saying he liked something that helps him move on. And we are meant to understand it helps him survive long enough to create Rent. And this is really quite true, not just about Larson, but about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. My colleague, Laura Collins Hughes, has a piece in which he's called the enthusiast in chief or something like that, for young writers and theater people. And the phenomenon you're talking about, John, originates in his deliberately taking an interest in the future of the form and in the people who might create it, in much the same way he felt that his life was changed by Oscar Hammerstein.
Do you really think that he's directly mentored people like that? I mean, Jonathan Larson, maybe, but like, where do you think is the Sondheim influence in musicals right now? Because honestly, I'm not sure I hear much of it at all.
Well, Pasek and Paul, certainly, Scott Frankel. I mean, these are not names well known to the public, but a lot of the people writing the best songs on Broadway today were either encouraged or specifically helped along the way by being given jobs as, say, a rehearsal pianist or a dance arranger by Sondheim, either on his shows or recommending them to other shows. And then just, you can't underestimate what it means to get an answering machine message or a letter from Stephen Sondheim saying, that was great. You're doing the kind of thing that makes me want to keep writing. When you're 25, that's an amazing thing. And we've been seeing on Twitter all week, just hundreds of these testimonials to what such letters and messages meant to so many people.
Stylistically, I'm not sure I hear much anymore. I felt like it was bigger in the 90s and maybe early '00s. And I think in the past decade, it's kind of moved away a bit.
It doesn't have to be in the same musical style. It's the approach.
Okay, well, right. I guess I was referring more specifically to the musical style.
I don't think he'd even want his particular musical language to be the one that these younger people are working with.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to be imitated necessarily, but it's just going to happen.
Well, it's too hard to imitate Sondheim.
I think very inadvertently he may have created a few monsters because the imitators are just awful, absolutely awful. When it's bad, want to be Sondheim is just, oh my God, it's really like it's nails on a blackboard for me.
Okay, so if we are going to close out with a philosophically simpatico but not nails on blackboard new or newish composer, who should we go out with and what should we hear?
I think the most Sondheim-y show, you know, in what we might call the post-Sondheim years, which is not to say since his death, but let's say in the last decade or so, is Grey Gardens by Scott Frankel and Michael Corey, as I mentioned. And I know for a fact that Sondheim adored two of the great songs in that show, one a ballad and one a charm number. The ballad is called Will You? And the charm number is called The Revolutionary Costume for Today. And they're both quite brilliant and very much in the Sondheim mode, although they don't musically recall him. But it's in the cleverness, the seriousness, the psychological layering, the attention to how to use rhyme to underline meaning and not just to tickle the ear for no reason. All of those things are present in that show and in particular in those songs. That's my vote.
Sounds good.
That sounds good until you hear it.
Yeah. Oh,
zing.
Wow. I didn't know that we were going to end on gunfire, but okay. That is our show. Thankfully, we are remote. So Jesse and Elizabeth are in different rooms in different cities. So they
come
don't
on,
have
that,
to.
That's the best part. The best part is having spirited arguments about music. Otherwise, music is dead.
Yeah, so, but I'm glad because I would still like to have both of you survive this episode. So I appreciate it. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Jesse. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Email me, podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio. That's Spotify, Apple, Stitcher. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We will be back next week. This is The Revolutionary Costume for Today.
The best kind of shoes to express bold views are strapless mules and assertive hues like fuchsia or peach, except on the beach, in which case you wear flats. When I stood before the nation at Jack's inauguration, in a high heel pump, I got the jump on Jackie's pillbox hats.